This is the BBC.
Hello and welcome to the podcast of The Life Scientific, first broadcast on BBC Radio 4. I'm Jamal Khalili and my mission is to interview the most fascinating and important scientists alive today and to find out what makes them tick. Jennifer Doudna's research has transformed biology. And this is not an understatement. Her work has given us the tools to edit genes more precisely than ever before. Her scientific career began with work to understand the action of RNA, part of the machinery of every cell. But after a meeting in 2005 with a colleague at the University of California, Berkeley, where Jennifer is currently a professor of chemistry and of molecular and cell biology, she changed her direction of research. Through collaborations all over the world, she's since developed the gene editing system called CRISPR-Cas9. Don't worry, it's an acronym which we'll be dissecting later. She's been awarded multiple prizes for her work, but it's created opportunities, both for good and for ill. So, and unlike many scientists who leave the ethical implications of the research to others, Jennifer Doudna has decided to engage with her critics. Jennifer, welcome to The Life Scientific.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
You said that we're on the cusp of a new era in the history of life on Earth. What did you mean by this?
Well, I think we're at a point where technologies are converging to allow scientists to do experiments and research that has frankly never been possible before. I think we feel there's a burgeoning opportunity to understand life at a level that we haven't been able to in the past, and also to control life in ways that hasn't been possible in the past. So it's a very exciting moment. I think all of my colleagues in biology feel this sense of, you know, just incredible excitement about the opportunities we now have.
We are going to come back to this later, but let's find out a little bit more about you. You were brought up on Big Island, Hawaii, an idyllic place. I visited there a few years ago on holiday. What was it like living there as a child?
Well, I was growing up in a town called Hilo in the 1970s. It was a time of both incredible beauty and discovery for me as a kid, but also, quite frankly, incredible cultural challenges. My family moved there when I was 7 years old. It's an island that has active volcanoes. It has an incredibly rich history, cultural history of different groups from around the, particularly South Pacific, that have come to Hawaii over long periods of time. And I found that all very fascinating. But there was also a lot of distrust, I would say, of Caucasians like me that were moving to Hawaii in that decade, and a lot of resentment of whites. And so I felt, I was in a racial minority, actually, and I often felt a very strong sense of resentment from my classmates and from other just people that I would encounter in the town that I had to learn how to deal with.
What was your coping mechanism if you felt maybe some sort of pressure or difficulties growing up at school, as you say, as a racial minority in Hawaii?
Well, I think in many ways I retreated into books and to ideas. You know, I remember spending a lot of time. This was in the days before, kids were sort of overscheduled and all of that. I just, I had afternoons after school. I was often hanging out in my room on my bed, reading books and just kind of thinking, daydreaming about things. And this was, of course, before the internet, so that I couldn't Google anything. I just had to, if I had an idea or a question about something, I had to actually go to the library and look it up, or go to an encyclopedia and try to figure it out. And so I did a lot of that. Certainly one of the early books I read that had a big impact on me was Jim Watson's book called The Double Helix, about the discovery of the structure of DNA. And I still remember being maybe about 12 or 13 years old and reading that book and being utterly astounded that it was possible to do experiments in a lab that would uncover the structure of a molecule. It just seemed kind of mind-blowing. And I remember thinking, wow, that would be fun.
Early in your research career, you found yourself working on RNA. Can you explain what RNA is and what it was that got you interested in it in the first place?
Well, RNA was something I never thought much about in high school, or I probably didn't even know about it in high school. In college, I learned about RNA as a chemical copy of DNA that cells make to basically to transfer the information stored in DNA into the functional molecules that are the kind of the workhorses of the cell called proteins. And RNA was just kind of the intermediary. It seemed like a very boring molecule, frankly, and I wasn't interested at all. And then I got to graduate school, and I started working with a fantastic scientist named Jack Szostak. And he explained to me that, he was thinking about a very, very big question in science, kind of one of those unanswerables about the origin of life. You know, how did life get started? You know, it's one of those really amazing sort of questions. And he was thinking about it from a chemical perspective. And one of the hypotheses in the field at the time was that maybe RNA molecules originally, if you went back far enough, had actually been very, very interesting molecules that did everything. They stored genetic information, which they can do, and they also might have had the ability to do interesting chemistry, like make copies of that genetic information. And so in his lab, he was beginning to investigate that possibility experimentally. And that's what I started working on as a graduate student. And I've sort of been influenced by that line of thinking, I would say, ever since.
Presumably have been basic research. I mean, were you thinking at that time about potential medical applications?
Well, you know, if I'm honest, you know, we always write into our grants that,
you have to say what it's useful for,
right? You have to
right?
say what it's useful for, you know, and we hope we're going to cure cancer someday and that sort of thing. But the truth was that certainly in those days, I was very much focused on, I would say, just fundamental questions in biology, really understanding the basics of the way that these molecules functioned in cells, the different kinds of activities they might have. And always in the back of my mind was the bigger question, which, you know, again, kind of came from my graduate training, which was thinking about what this meant for evolution and the evolution of life.
When did you first hear about CRISPR?
Well, I think it was in the mid-2000s, shortly after some papers were published in 2005, one of which was authored by Francisco Mojica, a Spanish scientist who was really one of the people that recognized very early on that bacteria can store bits of viruses, the viruses that can infect these bacterial cells. These bits of viral DNA can actually be saved in the genome, in the DNA of the bacterium. And they're saved in a very special place in the DNA called CRISPR, which is an acronym. It stands for Clusters of Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeats.
I'm glad you unpacked that, not me.
You're much enlightened now, I'm sure. But basically, it just refers to a pattern of DNA sequences that occur over and over again in one portion of the chromosome of a bacterial cell, one section of the DNA. And Jill Banfield, my colleague at Berkeley, who actually drew my attention to CRISPR sequences originally, was one of the scientists who was studying bacteria in their native environment. So she was sequencing DNA from bacteria that grow in, you know, crazy places like old acid mine tailings where the pH is, you know, very acidic, like pH 1 or something. And there actually are organisms that will grow in those environments. And a lot of them had these CRISPR sequences in the genome. And she found that they change over time. So it was clear that they weren't just static in the genome of these bacteria, but they were changing, and they were changing in response to viruses. So it really looked like an active system somehow that was saving, you know, a genetic record. It kind of, I like to call it a genetic vaccination card. It's like keeping a little genetic record of bacteria, of viruses that had infected bacteria in the past.
All right. So they're saving bits of the virus so that when that particular virus attacks the bacteria again, they can recognize it. That's the basic idea.
That's the basic idea. And do something about it. That's right. Protect the cell from infection.
And I gather at the time you thought this was the most complicated area of research you'd ever been exposed to, or certainly obscure.
Yes, I would say, yeah, that's maybe a better word to use. I think obscure is right, because, you know, it was an area of research that was certainly the most mysterious of anything I'd ever worked on, in the sense that virtually nothing was known. You know, there was just this observation about sequences and a fascinating hypothesis, but no idea about, you know, first of all, was that hypothesis correct? And if it was, how did it work? You know, and my work has always focused on the how questions, right? You know, sort of how does this work? And so after being introduced to these, the presence of these sequences and what they were, and this acronym, in the mid-2000s, a publication in 2007 had a big impact on us because that was a paper that was published by a group working at the food company called Danisco, which is now part of DuPont. It was a team of scientists that were food scientists. They were working on bacteria that are used to culture cheese and yogurt and things like that. And one of the challenges in the food industry was to deal with viruses that infect these cultures and can destroy the food products that they're making. And so there was a very strong push on the more applied side to figure out how to protect bacterial cultures from being destroyed by viruses. And so that had led to scientists at this company realizing that there was an interesting possibility that some bacteria, including the ones they were using for culturing yogurt, had CRISPR systems that could be perhaps harnessed as a protective mechanism. And to figure out if that was true, they did some genetic experiments showing that when you knocked out or, you know, basically removed parts of these CRISPR arrays and the associated genes that are part of those systems from bacteria, the bacteria became much more susceptible to viruses. And so that was really an important discovery because it really, I think, for many people was the, you know, the tip-off that there was something very interesting there, something interesting to study.
And certainly your curiosity was piqued and your lab started working and doing more basic research on the CRISPR system.
We did. Yeah, that's right. Between 2007, I think it was, and 2011, we actually focused on, we were doing work on various CRISPR systems that have multiple proteins that work together with copies of the CRISPR sequence in the form of RNA molecules to find and destroy viruses.
And then things began to take off at a conference in Puerto Rico in 2011.
Right. I went to a conference in 2011 to present some of our work on that topic. It was a meeting of the American Society of Microbiology. And at that point, the whole sort of very small but kind of growing field of CRISPR biology had reached a level where that meeting decided to have a whole session on CRISPRs. And so I was there in that capacity. And that meeting, I met Emmanuel Charpentier, who was at the time working at Umeå University in Sweden, and she is a medical microbiologist and studying a particular human pathogen called Streptococcus pyogenes, which is a bacterium that causes the flesh-eating disease, if you've heard of that, in people that have a compromised immune system. So it's an important pathogen. And her research had uncovered, she had come to CRISPRs through that line of research. She was looking at just sort of the natural pathways that control gene expression in these bacteria. And she had stumbled across a very abundant RNA molecule in those cells that turned out to come from the CRISPR system. And it was an RNA that she named TRACER RNA. And that RNA in work that she had published in right before we got to that conference in Puerto Rico had shown that the TRACER RNA was an important part of the pathway of CRISPR immunity in this bug, Streptococcus pyogenes. It played an important role in producing the copies of RNA that were actually used to find and kill viruses. And so we met at that conference, and during a wonderful sort of walk around old San Juan, Puerto Rico, a very European feel to it, and, you know, kind of walking up and down these streets and talking about the science we were doing in our labs, you know, she said, you know, I've been thinking about contacting you because I think there's a very interesting project that we could work on together, and that is to figure out the molecular function of a protein encoded by a gene called Cas9 that's found in this type of CRISPR system in Streptococcus pyogenes. And so it seemed like a great opportunity to work together. And that was really the beginning of what became a wonderful collaboration between our labs, very international, involving students from various parts of Europe who teamed up and worked across the ocean to share ideas.
It's an interesting collaboration that she's based in northern Sweden, you're based in California. I mean, how does that work in practice?
In a word, Skype.
Right.
Now, certainly modern technology helped a lot.
And at what point did you realize the potential of this technique, that you could take CRISPR beyond just what it does inside a bacteria, but use it to target and then, you know, cut out specific parts of the genome in other organisms?
Well, I think here what's fascinating is thinking about the way that scientific research can converge with seemingly unrelated areas of science. And this was certainly true here. So in our case, you know, Christoph, the student in Emmanuel's lab, was working with Martin in my lab, and they were doing experiments that eventually led to an understanding of the function at a molecular level of the Cas9 protein. It turned out to be an RNA-guided DNA cutting protein. And what that means is that you can think about it almost like a molecular scissors that could be programmed with little pieces of RNA to find a certain DNA sequence in a cell or in a naked DNA molecule and cut the DNA. Fascinating. And so we, you know, did the biochemical experiments to figure that out. And once that molecular mechanism was clear, that immediately brought to mind a whole seemingly different line of research that suddenly dovetailed very nicely with our own work. And that was the field of gene editing, genome engineering. Because what had emerged over the last, you know, the previous sort of couple of decades was that in plants and animal cells, when DNA is broken, which happens routinely due to damage or even just during cell division, cells have to repair the broken DNA, and they do so using precise pathways that can alter a DNA sequence at a site where a double-stranded break has occurred. And so scientists appreciating that had recognized that you could use that to engineer the DNA of cells, effectively to rewrite the DNA sequence in cells at precise places if you could introduce a DNA break at a desired place where you wanted to induce a change. And so the question was, how do you do that? I mean, that's pretty hard, right? How do you do it? And so a number of very clever scientists had come up with ways of generating what I would call engineered proteins. These are proteins that could be built in the lab to have the ability to grab on to a particular DNA sequence and make a cut. They could work beautifully for this. So the challenge was, you had to engineer a new protein every time you wanted to do an experiment, right? So it just meant that it was quite costly and time-consuming to do. But the thing was that, so when we did the work on Cas9, we realized that that bypassed this whole problem of having to make a new protein for every experiment, because you use the same protein, right? And you reprogram it trivially by changing this little piece of RNA that it's holding on to, something that, you know, we teach our first-year graduate students, even college students, even now high school students, how to do this, right? And so it made the whole challenge of introducing a double-stranded break to trigger a change to the DNA sequence, it made that suddenly a trivial thing to do.
You published a seminal paper in the journal Science in 2012. Remarkably, that was just 1 year after you met Emmanuel, and it's only 5 years ago. But the scientific community seemed to realize incredibly quickly the importance of CRISPR-Cas9 for the whole sort of area of gene editing.
It did. Suddenly it opened the door to all kinds of questions that you could now ask as a scientist. So it's just been, you know, it's been a fascinating 5 years, because it's been so exciting to see all the different ways that this tool is now being used across different kinds of biological systems.
Well, around 2014, Jennifer Doudna, you felt you had to leave the comfort and safety of your research lab and venture out into the real world to take a public stand on the ethical implications of this technology. What was it that prompted this?
Well, during couple of years after Emmanuel Charpentier and I published our work in the summer of 2012, what happened in that period of time was truly remarkable. I mean, we saw laboratories worldwide beginning to adopt this gene editing technology called CRISPR-Cas9, using it in all sorts of organisms, plants, fish, human cells, stem cells, all sorts of things. And that was very exciting, for sure. But I also had sort of this growing unease. And my unease came because I had the feeling that, you know, the science was moving faster than anyone outside of the scientific community could appreciate. I realized, for example, that nobody in our government or in our regulatory agencies had any idea that this was going on. And yet it was such a powerful technology that it gave scientists the ability to do things like make a new strain of mice where every cell in the mouse has a change to the DNA that's a heritable change. It could be transmitted to future generations and do so in just 5 weeks. Right. And furthermore, this isn't true just in mice, but it also could be done in rats and it also could be done in monkeys. And when the monkey work was first published in early 2014, for me, that was probably the event that really kind of made me realize I have to get involved in this conversation. I can't leave it to others to do that. I really need to be involved because, after all, I felt like I'd been a player in bringing this technology to the point that it was at. And so I really felt, in a way, I guess, a responsibility to start a more open discussion about how do we as a culture, we as a species, how do we use a technology that gives us effectively the ability to control evolution?
And because it was getting closer and closer to being used with humans.
I wondered about that at the time. I mean, when I saw the work being done in monkeys, I said, well, why wouldn't this work in a human embryo? It probably would. And how can I be sure there isn't somebody thinking that would be an interesting thing to do? And suppose they did, and what would the public reaction be if suddenly, out of seemingly nowhere, there were, you know, human embryos that were being edited using this technology? It was kind of a horrifying thought to me at the time.
Because, of course, if we think, you know, you can edit the genome of a living human, but if you're editing the genome within an embryo, that's something that's going to be passed down the generations. Is that the germline editing?
Germline editing, that's right, yeah.
And yeah. That's what carries the huge ethical implications.
It does.
That you need to be discussed. You've been instrumental in calling for a global pause on clinical applications, particularly of germline editing that would cause heritable changes. But what's to stop others around the world just simply ignoring this call?
As you said, there could be scientists in parts of the world where there aren't a lot of regulatory guidelines who could be proceeding with experiments that others elsewhere would think are inappropriate to be doing. And so what do we do about that? Well, it's, you know, I think it's very hard to think about how you would enforce any kind of regulatory framework globally. I mean, you know, geez, that's, yeah, we can't do that in other areas of human life. So why would we be able to do it in science? I think it's hard. But I do think that there's a very strong tradition in the scientific community of scientists interacting and discussing and, frankly, cooperating around powerful technologies that have been developed in the past.
But then presumably there may well come a time soon when this technology will be deemed safe. What happens then? Do you then just relax this pause on clinical applications and just allow a free-for-all? Or,
well, in my opinion, I think it's important that this technology proceed in a very thoughtful and stepwise fashion. So, you know, one thing that's happened in the last few years with the advent of this CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing technology is that a few jurisdictions, including the United Kingdom, actually, have approved the use of CRISPR-Cas9 in early human embryos. These are not embryos that are intended for implantation to create a child, but they're to perform research. And so these are, you know, embryos that come from in vitro fertilization clinics, for example, that are not going to be used for implantation. I think that what we're likely to see over time is that, you know, in my opinion, we'll see that this technology can be used in those embryos, right, to make changes, just as we've seen in many other systems. And I think as the technology continues to improve and develop, it will eventually become safe to use it. I can't tell you how long that will take, but I think it's coming. And so when that happens, I think you're right that there will then be very strong pressure in certain jurisdictions to use it to create people that have those modifications. And I think we need to be ready for that time. And that's why I've been very vocal about starting the conversation now.
because, you know, many listeners, I'm sure you won't be surprised to hear, will recoil in horror at the prospect of this sort of profound meddling, you know, playing God. What do you say to them?
I think it's an incredible opportunity and a challenge for human beings. I think that the opportunity is that we now have the ability to correct, or even, you know, if you really take it out long enough, you could imagine removing very deleterious sequences of DNA from the human population. What if you could get rid of the cystic fibrosis gene? For families that suffer from this disease, I can tell you they would love to see that happen. So I think there's that aspect to it. But I think maybe what people feel more repulsed by, possibly, or maybe probably, is the idea that, you know, it's sort of the whole idea of eugenics in a way, right? It's the idea that, you know, would we really want a world where, you know, we're controlling the genetics of every person? I mean, if that sounds sort of, you know, it makes me feel repulsed too, because for me, one of the beauties of human life is the variety.
Jennifer, until recently, you spent your career in research labs devoted to your science. Now you're discussing the ethics of the applications of your research. You're involved in a startup biotech company. You're giving talks all over the world. Most notably, you're collecting many prestigious awards. How hard has it been for you to be away from the lab for such long periods?
Hard. And I'm not only away from the lab, I'm away from my family, you know, and it's been a big change in my life, for sure. I remember a moment, this was probably already about 2.5 years ago. The whirlwind of my life was already kind of, you know, picking up at that time. And I was invited to speak at a meeting up in the Napa Valley to some business people. Beautiful place. It was, you know, up in the wine country. And I got there early in the afternoon, and my talk wasn't until the evening. So I had a little time to take a walk. And so I took a hike up in the rolling golden hills of California with these live oaks. It was just, you know, fabulous. And I got up to the top of a hill, and I could see a long way. And I just, you know, was looking out across these rolling golden hills. And I had this very profound moment, you know, where I suddenly felt this incredible sense of sadness. And I was trying to figure out why, you know, like, why am I sad? I mean, I'm at this beautiful place, and I'm up here, you know, I'm invited to speak to a distinguished group, and I'm talking about my science, and the science is really fun. And why am I feel sad? And I realized that I felt sad because I was thinking about the before and after of my life, you know, that my life had profoundly changed and that it would never go back, you know, that I would never have the kind of time that I did in the past, or at least not any time in the near future, to just hang out in my lab with my students and, you know, ruminate over data and putz around on weekends with my son. And, you know, it was just sort of this feeling that my life had changed in a very profound way, and that in many ways it was out of my control.
And it's a permanent change. You don't think there'll come a time when you can retreat back to the lab and regain that old life?
I certainly hope so, but I don't see it coming in the near future, let's say.
Jennifer Doudna, thank you very much for sharing your Life Scientific.
It's been great to be here. Thanks for chatting.